This month's big news is that the results from the National Audit Project No. 5 have been released. On the 10th of September, the official report was launched at the Royal Society of Medicine and swiftly echoed in the national press. Awareness under general anaesthesia represents a fundamental failure in the service our specialty provides, the repercussions of which can be devastating for both patients and anaesthetists. Joining me to discuss this landmark study, it's my great pleasure to once again be talking with the NAT5 lead, Professor Jaydeep Pandit. Professor Pandit, welcome back to the BJA podcast and congratulations on the completion of NAT5.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Now, accidental awareness under general anaesthesia, or AAGA, is a rare event. If we can start back at the beginning, prior to NAT5, what did we know about the incidence of accidental awareness under anaesthesia?
Well, the majority of studies were prospective trials, I would say smaller scale in the sense of consisting of a few thousand patients maximum, and they employed a technique called Bryce questionnaire. And this is a method wherein patients are asked after surgery, sort of semi-directly if they were aware. What they're actually asked is two key questions. One is, what's the last thing you remember before going to sleep? And what's the next thing you remember? And from their answers, the researcher surmises whether they were aware or not during the anaesthetic. The reported incidence based on those studies has been very consistent at about 1 to 2 per 1,000. That's about 1 to 500 or 600.
I've used the Bryce questionnaire once before, and my impression was there's quite a degree of subjectivity to using it.
I think that's right. And we pointed out several questions about it. It's one of these unusual things that has been widely adopted in its pretty much its original format, and never really been questioned or discussed extensively. It's simply been used, and to the extent that some authorities suggest it's a sort of gold standard for detecting awareness. But as you yourself indicate, any user of it very quickly realizes that what one elicits is an extremely vague report that is highly subjective. And the degree to which it's later assessed to the same depth that we assessed the reports that we received in NAT5 is, of course, questionable.
So moving on from that, could you just remind us briefly on what methodology you used for NAT5?
So ours was pretty much in the same line as the previous NAPs, NAT4 and NAT3. It was essentially a data registry over a year, over a calendar year, actually spanning midway through 1 year to the next, and a reporting system. So each hospital had a local coordinator, consultant, anaesthetist. And they were asked diligently on a monthly basis to check for reports across their entire hospital. So not just those received by the anaesthetic department, but from surgery, nursing, medicine, gastroenterology, radiology, etc. And we even had liaison systems with local general practices and national psychological and psychiatric services. And they were asked to file not just positive entries every month to us, so in other words, not only when they had a report, but also a zero return. So if they didn't have any reports for that month, they were asked to say so and to report it to us, and if they didn't, we would chase it up. And what they reported was on an anonymous, secure website, and they were able to upload all the details of the case anonymously, so the relevant anaesthetic records, the surgical operation, the patient characteristics, etc. And it was a double-blind method in that we not only did we not know the details of the patient at all, but nothing of where the report originated from in the country.
When you say we, of course, that's the review panel process.
That's right. So on receipt of these reports on a monthly basis, we collated them, sort of formatted them in a standardized format for discussion. And each report was then formally reviewed by the panel. And what the panel did was divide itself up into small groups of at least three each, and then meet at the end of their small review process to rediscuss in the full panel review. So that each report was carefully discussed twice, at least twice, at two levels, with some reports even that were interesting or merited further discussion brought back a further time.
That review panel process can't have been easy. How did it work in terms of ensuring you maintained objectivity?
Well, we were mindful of that, and we instituted several systems, one of which was to have a very clear format for our outputs pre-agreed. So there was a standardized form of outputs so that we knew that we were all working within the same sort of framework. Clearly, we had to develop these rather de novo because this is a novel study. We were also mindful of sort of analytical biases, you might say, such as groupthink, where it's possible that a group or a strong person in the group comes to an early decision and the rest of the group sort of simply falls behind that. Other things like hindsight bias, because, of course, we knew that these were, in inverted commas, negative outcomes, so there's a tendency to assume something must have gone wrong. What you really need to do is to, you know, sort of pretend or assume that we're there from the start and ask the reverse question, you know, were reasonable things done and could the adverse outcome have been reasonably anticipated? So at each stage, the panel was reminded of this. And of course, the double layer where people were first in groups and then the major discussion, allowed that flexibility and prevented those sorts of things happening.
So once you decided that a case was in fact a genuine case of AAGA, how did you go about categorising that within the group?
Yeah, so again, these were largely pre-agreed categories, but as we reviewed the cases, we realised that some new categories were necessary. We did it on two levels. One was the sort of the degree of evidence, as you say, one extreme, some reports of awareness were substantiated and verified independently. So, for example, the patient reported a certain conversation that the medical team confirmed had happened. And yet at the other extreme were very vague reports that, either couldn't be verified at all simply because of the circumstances or actually refuted. And then there was the group that were what we call statement only. This is where the patient made a statement that they'd been aware, but usually because of the time elapsed, often decades since the operation, there were no medical notes at all to indicate what or whether the patient had had an anaesthetic or surgery. So we included them, and there is a chapter devoted to these statement-only cases, but clearly they're of limited robustness compared with the verified cases. So that was one. And then the other was certain subcategories that were clearly demarcated. For example, the group of patients who reported awareness when in fact they'd had sedation and there was no intention to give an anaesthetic. Clearly this was a class of its own. Then there was the group that originated in intensive care. And we know that in intensive care, consciousness levels are intentionally varied up and down on a sort of daily or hourly basis. Clearly it's difficult to dissect out sometimes when or how the awareness may have resulted. And the other group of categories was, of course, the syringe swaps. These were the unfortunate episodes where, in fact, the neuromuscular blocking agent had been given before the anaesthetic. And clearly, in a sense, that accidental awareness, but in fact, more accurately, it's unintentional paralysis. So we clearly realised that this was a class of its own as well.
And once something had been deemed to be a genuine case of AAGA, did you then have any way of measuring the impact to the patient?
Absolutely, yes. One of our panel members, Dr. Helen Torrible, developed trust risk manager. She modified the existing NPSA, the National Patient Safety Agency, scale of harm, which was originally designed for physical harm. She adapted it for our purposes, which was really psychological harm. And so having developed that, we applied that to estimate the longer term, and I say longer term inverted commas, because we weren't cross-examining the patient, we only had a second-hand report, the longer term impact there had been on that scale.
Okay, so looking at the NAT5 results, what was the bottom line in terms of incidence of AAGA?
Well, we accepted 300 reports 141 of them that we classed as certain, probable, or possible. And we focused our analysis on these. I think people are very interested in incidents. And straight away, looking at these reports and the numbers we have, it's very easy to calculate different incidences. And in the paper, you'll see a table where there is a huge range of incidences quoted. And I think that's very important. So the aggregate incidence was about 1 in 19,000. But within that, there are different ways of focusing. So, for example, without neuromuscular blockade, the incidence is vanishingly small. It's 1 in 136,000. But with neuromuscular blockade, it's 1 in 8,000. And so on. So incidence is only one part of the story, but it shows that there's a great heterogeneity of how common this is, depending on the circumstances. And I think that's an important result.
Absolutely, especially for us as practitioners, we need to know which cases and which patients are going to be at increased risk. So drilling down a little deeper onto that, if we can start with the different phases of anaesthesia, what did NAP5 reveal there?
Well, the commonest phase in which awareness occurred was in what we call the induction phase. And what we mean by that is after, from the point of anaesthetic induction to before the commencement of surgery. And any time during that phase, almost half the reports were located to that phase of anaesthesia. And about 18%, just under 20%, were located to the emergence phase. So this is after surgery has stopped the patient before full return of consciousness. So together, what I've called the dynamic phases of anaesthesia constitute two-thirds of the reports. And the stable maintenance phase, that is during surgery, is the minority. It's only a third.
And looking specifically at the conduct of anaesthesia, we've already touched on one of the big findings concerning neuromuscular blockade, but how did this develop and were there any other risk factors you identified?
Well, to add to the neuromuscular blockade story, particularly when neuromuscular blockade is coupled with non-use of nerve monitoring. So we found a striking underuse of nerve stimulator use in the awareness cohort versus the general population of cases. And the third factor related to neuromuscular blockade is lack of reversal. So it's what I call the unholy trinity.
Right.
Use neuromuscular blockade, don't monitor it, and don't reverse it, that really almost guaranteed to lead to awareness or perception thereof. So I think that's a really important and arguably the main message of this report, is how we use and monitor neuromuscular blockade. There were clearly other risk factors we identified consistent with our phase of anaesthesia result, that rapid sequence induction, particularly using thiopentone, so out of hour surgery conducted by trainees, the peak age of incidence appeared to be young middle-aged adults rather than children or the very elderly, and both obstetrics and cardiothoracics were types of surgery where awareness we found was more common.
Sounds like your average appendectomy is the perfect recipe for AAGA being commonly done out of hours on young adults with a junior trainee delivering a classic RSI followed by neuromuscular blockade.
Yes, particularly if the patient is pregnant on top of that, yes.
Right.
Yeah.
So I'm sure we'll come back to talking about RSIs and neuromuscular blockade a little bit later. But when talking to patients, we've talked briefly about incidents. What sort of instances should we now be quoting in what's now the recognised National Audit Project optimistic, pessimistic type of way?
Well, I think this was a difficult one for us on the panel to the degree to which our advice on this should be explicit. What we've done is clearly provided a great deal of information that will inform how consent is best taken and information is conveyed to patients. We think the best judge of how to communicate risk and take consent from an individual patient is clearly the anaesthetist providing the care. And a numerical estimate of risk is only one part of the story. The anaesthetist on top of that needs to indicate what the impact is likely to be. So patients need to know how common the adverse event or complication is likely to be for sure, but they also need to know what that complication is going to feel like or what it's going to do to them. And thirdly, what steps are being taken to minimize that risk, regardless of how numerically common or uncommon it is. So I think that in the general sense, and what we've said in the report is by all means outline the risk, and people can use the risk that they feel is most appropriate to the patient in front of them. So certainly one could quote the aggregate risk of 1 in 19,000. That's certainly acceptable. Or if it's a particular patient, say a cesarean section, one could quote the much higher risk that we find of 1 in 670. There are anaesthetists out there who strongly believe in the Bryce results, and they're entitled to quote the average figure from Bryce of 1 in 600. You know, that's a numerical, you know, figure, and the degree to which patients are informed by that is open to debate. But the second thing, and more important than that, is to outline to patients, particularly when using neuromuscular blockade, that there may be brief periods in which the patient may feel weak or unable to move, but that this will be temporary and it will pass. So it is not interpreted in a catastrophic way. And to mitigate the risk, one can talk about nerve stimulator monitoring or depth of anesthesia monitoring if that is within the scope of practice. And all this can be, the more detailed information can be provided in the written literature. So I think we're not overemphasizing a numerical figure to quote, and it's not our intention to do that, but to remind anaesthetists that they need to discuss all three elements of information and consent.
Coming back to some of the main lessons learned from NAP5, we've talked about neuromuscular blockade and the unholy trinity, as you put it, but there also appeared to be a significant overrepresentation of AAGA cases undergoing rapid sequence induction. What were the panel's thoughts on this finding?
Well, we do recommend that the concept of what a rapid sequence induction is and how it is defined and what its essential components are need to be better defined. We try to look in the literature, and there's a common sort of understanding of broadly what it is. But if you try and find exactly what it is, for example, is opiate use always essential? Why is thiopentone particularly used, etc. It's very difficult to find justification for these elements of it. So I think certainly there is a need to revisit what a rapid sequence induction is, what it's supposed to do, particularly in the modern era. For example, if it's the case that addition of opiate or using propofol rather than thiopentone in higher doses or additional doses should intubation be prolonged, if that is going to reduce risk of awareness without introducing more harm, then that's something that needs to be researched and established. So that's our sort of broad feeling on the rapid sequence induction story.
Moving forward with the anaesthetic, post-induction seems to be a high-risk time for AAGA. I noted several cases were associated with transfer from the anaesthetic room to the operating theatre.
That's right, and I think that's, after neuromuscular blockade, arguably the second important message of NAP5, that what we call mind the gap. Again, we're focusing on the induction phase as the most common phase where this occurs. And the gap consists of a sort of pharmacological element, which is the sort of redistribution of drug after intravenous induction before volatile concentration rises to an acceptable level. The gap also includes gap of positioning the patient, moving the patient from anaesthetic room to theatre, or even in theatre, perhaps of positioning the patient into the right position for surgery, where there are disconnections, brief interruptions of supply that are not reintroduced after the movement. So this has caused us to recommend a checklist, a simple ABCD checklist that we've suggested should actually be an addition to the existing WHO checklist. Because at the moment, the WHO checklist is highly surgical orientated, and there aren't any anaesthetic specific steps. But our proposed checklist suggests some anaesthetic-specific checks to ensure, amongst other things, that there is adequate delivery of anaesthetic after such movement.
And so the idea of this checklist is that it's going to be done at the same time as the WHO checklist, or just before, but also when the patient is being moved either from operating table to trolley or vice versa.
That's right. So, I mean, in essence, the WHO checklist really starts in the anaesthetic room before induction when certain checks are done. And at that point is an opportunity for the anaesthetic team to go through the ABCD, in other words, discuss what the airway breathing circulation plan is, as well as check the D, which is the drugs, as well as check that the drugs are drawn up in a way that is not going to lead to syringe swaps, for example. And then E, being effective team, check that the team is qualified and competent and able to do the proposed steps for induction of anaesthesia. And then so the second component of the WHO checklist is, of course, in theatre, in the timeout. And at that point, again, is an opportunity to say, right, here we are, we're about to start. Let's go through ABCD. Do we have the airway breathing and circulation under control and the drugs, in other words, is the anaesthetic actually being given and administered? So exactly as you say.
Moving forward then towards the maintenance phase of anaesthesia, which I think probably is the phase of which both patients and anaesthetists are going to be most anxious about there being a problem with anaesthetic delivery. And fortunately, it did appear in NAP5 to be the minority. But where there were cases of failure of anaesthetic delivery during maintenance, what were the factors that came into play there?
Well, the first thing to say, I mean, this is a novel result because almost all other reports and studies have assumed or focused on the maintenance phase and sort of assumed that this is the most common phase. And we've challenged that and found that it isn't. Even within the maintenance phase, half the cases occurred at knife to skin. So were actually hangovers from the induction phase. So the factors that would otherwise have caused awareness in the induction phase, you know, just literally happened to occur at the moment of knife to skin. So technically we're in the maintenance phase, but with the same causality as the induction phase. And also a proportion where after, you know, surgery, the main part of surgery was over, as it were, the last stitches going in. In other words, too early cessation of anaesthetic. So in a sense, there was still dynamism, as it were, involved in the maintenance phases, and only half were truly in the middle. And this phase was often difficult to explain. So it had the highest proportion, about a quarter of these. It was unclear what had caused or led to the awareness in that phase. And this is where we do raise the possibility of some sort of intrinsic resistance on the part of the patient, perhaps genetic. So in a sense, this is the phase in which perhaps some of the more interesting reasons as to what's causing awareness may in future come about. But there was nothing striking as such. We did identify a general tendency for underdosing, whether to titrate to a low blood pressure or sometimes to a low depth of anaesthesia monitor reading, so that anaesthetists were reducing the agent concentration to titrate to that result, but a much more interesting sort of period, I think.
And is there anybody doing any work on an intrinsic resistance to anaesthesia, or is it so rare it's difficult to study?
It's so rare it's difficult to study. There have been one or two suggestions. Clearly in the animal literature, people are trying to create transgenic animals that are resistant to anaesthetics. In Australia, the Australian New Zealand College of Anaesthetists has recently started a genetic database to see if genes can be identified as conferring a degree of resistance. And I think that's very interesting in the context of what we've found.
It certainly would be fascinating if an intrinsic resistance to, or a reason for an intrinsic resistance to anaesthesia was discovered. Moving on to emergence. And there were quite a few reports in Emergency said the actual dynamic phases made up 2/3 of the AAGA reports.
Yeah.
It occurs to me that emergence from anaesthesia is almost the beginning of awareness, but patients are reporting AAGA. What's your take on this?
Well, first of all, we did discuss and we had to carefully define this phase because, as you suggest, on the part of the anaesthetist, there is an overarching intention, you know, to return the patient to wakefulness. So in a sense, you could say, well, of course, awareness is to be expected. However, our definition of accidental awareness was that the patient felt that they were conscious at a time when they expected to be asleep. And I think that's very important. So in all these emergence phases, the patients fulfill that definition, that they were reporting consciousness at a time when they expected to be asleep. And in the main, the reason why they expected to be asleep for these emergence cases was that they were still paralyzed. And this really underlines the importance of the balance between anesthesia and paralysis in the emergence phase and how to get it right. What I mean by that is that paralysis is a very unpleasant sensation, clearly, for patients. Unlike pain, which they recognize and know what it is, paralysis is completely novel and alarming, and that creates a distress and a long-term impact. And what we found in the emergence cases was essentially that balance between anesthesia and paralysis had gone wrong, had been mismatched. So our recommendations are essentially, it's a reminder, but an important one, clearly, that anaesthetists should first ensure that there is a return of what we've called motor capacity, which is best assessed or assessed in large part by a nerve stimulator and by clinical signs such as spontaneous ventilation and indeed movement to command. And only then should they reduce the anesthetic. What was clearly happening was that very short-acting agents, including desflurane, were being switched off early before any reversal or assessment of motor function. And this is what created paralysis when awake at the end of surgery.
But it sounds from all of this like neuromuscular monitoring is likely to become a minimum monitoring standard. Do you think that's the way the AAGBI are going to go with this?
We have recommended very strongly that this should be considered as mandatory. It is somewhat of a surprise that it hasn't been or hadn't been hitherto. Perhaps it may be, and obviously working parties need to be set up, it may be that there's a lack of clear end point. For example, in the research world, I know there are strongly held views of whether it should be train of four or double burst or goodness knows what. But leaving that aside, if there's more clarity on what is appropriate objective test of motor capacity using a nerve stimulator, then I think very quickly there should be a mandatory element to this, yes.
You've mentioned syringe swaps, which is obviously a concern for all anaesthetists performing induction with neuromuscular blocking drugs. What was the incident, or what was the sort of baseline occurrence of this in NAP5?
Well, about 7% of the 300 cases were syringe swaps. So I think it was 17 out of the 300.
And looking at the reports, were there obvious causes to this? I mean, we're looking more in sort of the human factors side of things here, I suppose.
Yes, absolutely. There's a large human factors chapter devoted to all parts of the report. But of course, syringe swaps is one instance where it applies, par excellence. There were several components. Clearly, there were individual failings, you could say, of, tidiness and appropriateness in laying out syringes, but also distractions, staffing distractions, distractions in theatre. There were elements of things like where drugs were being stored, that in fact, with the best of intentions, certain neuromuscular blocking drugs have been stored outside of theatre to prevent this from happening. But that meant a greater degree of distraction. The staff had to leave theatre to get these things. And things like busy, over what were clearly overbooked, disorganized lists with change of theatre site at the last minute or in the middle of the list, which caused huge distractions. And certainly the overbooking of lists, we think we've mentioned that specifically, that there is a duty to identify, there are now models out there that do estimate when a list is appropriately booked or not. And a clearly overbooked list, objectively calculated, should be identified as a risk overall.
Yes, I mean, I suppose 17 cases is one of those patient safety things where we should really be aiming for zero.
I think 17, 20 cases per year is extremely high. I think even in the context of, almost 3 million general anaesthetics, because each of those cases was, the incidence of continued trauma was very high in that cohort.
It has a serious psychological impact.
It does, yes.
And is this something where working with industry we could potentially reduce sources of error by having different shaped or different coloured or pre-filled syringes?
Absolutely, and we've made that explicit recommendation that the relevant anaesthetic organisations should work with industry to try and achieve that. Clearly, it's unhelpful that all the packaging is pretty much the same. And trusts too should factor packaging into account when making choices as to which drugs to acquire. So there is a bit of incentivization that can come into play.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, depth of anaesthesia monitoring continues to be a controversial topic. And last time we spoke, NICE had just issued its guidance recommending the use of these devices. What were the findings on depth of anaesthesia monitoring from NAP5?
Well, the honest thing to say is that it's not very relevant to NAP5 for the simple reason that it's not really used in the UK. Our activity survey showed that overall its use is in only 2.8% of general anaesthetics. So I think anything used that little can't really be a major factor in the story. So having said that, overall we found, perhaps to our surprise, that there was a greater representation of depth of anaesthesia monitoring in the awareness cohort. Crudely, as if it was a risk factor. Because something presented is a risk. Now clearly that's a surprise, and we looked into it in more detail. And what we found was two things of I think great interest, and I think do reveal a potential benefit to these monitors. One is that in the modes of anaesthesia that are used, there is a heterogeneity in the risk conferred. So for example, we can work out hazard ratios of, say, using a volatile without neuromuscular blockade, a volatile with blockade, TEVA without blockade, and TEVA with blockade. And in short, it's the last that confers the greatest risk. So TEVA with neuromuscular blockade on a crude hazard ratio calculation confers about 4 times the risk for awareness. What we further found was that this is the group in which anaesthetists are naturally using the depth of anaesthesia monitors. So whereas in the other categories, depth of anaesthesia monitors are only used in about sort of 5% of cases or less, in the TEVA with blockade category, 25% of those are monitored with depth of anaesthesia monitors. And when we work out a sort of crude benefit effect, this is the same category in which the monitoring appears to have the greatest benefit. So what we've recommended is that logically and from our overview data, TEVA with neuromuscular blockade is a type of anaesthesia the anaesthetist should think very carefully and should probably consider using a depth of anaesthesia monitor. And I think that's a very interesting and positive outcome for targeted use of these monitors.
Finally, I wanted to ask you about AAGA during sedation. I think with increasing numbers of minimally invasive and endovascular procedures, sedation practice is becoming more widespread. In NAP5, the sedation cases were separated from the general anaesthesia cases and are subject to another paper that's obviously published in this issue. Just very quickly, what were the main findings and recommendations there?
Essentially, this was about communication, that for whatever reasons or for a multiplicity of reasons, patients were led to believe that they would, inverted commas, somehow be asleep during sedation. And when they were not, they were clearly regarded this as accidental awareness. And this brings to focus the meaning of sedation and the definition from the patient's perspective. And one thing that is new, a new contribution in that five, is that hitherto all the reports of sedation have looked at it from the operator's perspective. So, for example, when we define sedation as being maintaining verbal contact, that's actually completely unhelpful to the patient, because the patient wants to know what their state of mind will be like. And to some, maintaining verbal contact during the procedure is unacceptable. Therefore, we've actually redefined what sedation is and offered a very useful table to describe sedation from the patient's perspective. The long and short of it is that what we have recommended is to emphasize that during sedation, the patient is awake. Not asleep, but awake. And that further to that, there may be patchy memory loss. Not that can be guaranteed, but that is unpredictable. And we think that changing the information and the consent with that in mind will greatly reduce these clear miscommunications which go on. Remember that the incidence of awareness after sedation, as we report at 1 in 15,000, is commoner than the aggregate incidence after general anesthesia. So arguably, it's a much bigger problem, not a smaller problem. And it also had the longer term impact of a similar nature to awareness after anesthesia. So it's not a trivial problem.
Now, I believe you've quoted from the ASA registry that around 75% of people reporting awareness experience very severe distress.
That's right, yeah.
Well, that's all we have time for, but thank you very much for taking us on a very thorough tour through the results of this crucial piece of work. You can read the three NAP5 papers in both this month's BJA and Anesthesia. It just remains for me to say thank you once again to Professor Pandit for joining me, and congratulations to both you and the team on the completion of the National Audit Project number 5.
Thanks very much, Rick.
Thank you.